That was a section of 1/16th and Congress from drummer Allison Miller's new album Parlor Game, with violinist Jenny Scheinman, pianist Carmen Staff, and bassist Tony Shear. Allison Miller is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. Visit the OSIRIS page on jambase.com to check out all of our other shows. There are about 30 of them at this point on all sorts of subjects, and the network is growing all the time, so I'm sure there are at least one or two others that will be of interest to you as well. If you enjoy this podcast, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content on the website, burningambulance.com, and improve the podcast, so become a subscriber if you can. Allison Miller is a drummer who's best known for her jazz work, but she's also crossed a lot of genre borders, playing with folk, rock, and country bands. She's been leading her own band, Boom Tick Boom, for about 10 years, with Jenny Scheinman, Ben Goldberg on clarinet, Kirk Knufke on cornet, Myra Melford on piano, and Todd Sikafoos on bass. We talk a lot about that band in this interview, as well as her other work with singers like Ani DeFranco, Natalie Merchant, and Brandi Carlile. We also talk about her actual drum sound and about recording drums in the studio, so if you're in the mood for that kind of nerdy audio engineering stuff, you're in luck. I really enjoyed this conversation. She's a terrific musician with a really interesting background and a unique voice as a composer, so I hope you'll get as much out of this interview as I did. I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is a section of Daughter and Son from Glitter Wolf, the latest album from Boom Tick Boom, and after that, you'll hear my interview with Allison Miller. I guess I'll just kind of dive right in.
Okay.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start playing drums, and was it your first instrument?
No, it was not my drums weren't my first instrument. I started playing drums when I was around 8, but before that, I sang in church a lot, and I also played piano.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I still play piano, but it was kind of a situation where my mom is actually a pianist and a choral director, and when I told her I wanted to play drums, she said, "Okay, but you have to learn piano first."
Okay.
So that's what I did.
So how long did you continue with piano lessons and stuff?
I continued until one day I looked over at my mom and she was taking a nap. I don't know how long it was, And for me, it all felt like eternity because I just wanted to play the drums. But I would say maybe it was a year of playing piano. I mean, I continued to play piano, but maybe it was a year of lessons before I moved on to drums. But I didn't take drum lessons at first. I started really slowly. I first played at my summer music camp, and then I played in the, fourth grade band. And then after that, I played. I don't think it was until I was about 11 or 12 that I started studying privately.
And were you, you mentioned your mom played the piano and was a choral director, but do you come from an artistic family generally, and were your parents supportive, or,
Definitely an artistic family, especially on my mom's side of the family. Most of the women on my mom's side of the family are musicians.
Oh,
And
cool.
mostly, I would say, sacred musicians, church musicians, but there are a few that aren't. And yeah, it was just, I'm really fortunate because I grew up in a environment that encouraged music and really just made music a part of everyday life. We had two pianos growing up, and my mom likes to collect kind of eclectic instruments. So we had a couple hammered dulcimers. We also had a harpsichord and a small harp. We had all kinds of cool instruments in the house, and it just seemed kind of part of everyday life to play music and to listen to music. And also, my dad is a sound engineer, so I kind of
Oh.
grew up with a basically a recording studio in my basement of my house. It was really, I was talking about it recently in an interview, and I think I just realized how lucky I was that my dad was a recording engineer on the side. He had his day job to support the family, but then he had this studio in our basement, and a lot of the DC jazz musicians would come out to our place and make records there. So, when I was really young, I would sit on the staircase and listen to greats like Keeter Betts and Steve Novacell, James King. I'm naming all bass players, but Buck Hill, great alto player from DC. And even Etta Jones made a couple records down there in Houston person. So
Oh,
I was,
cool.
I was really lucky.
Do you can you remember a specific record or a live performance or something that drew you to the drums that made you say that's what I want to play?
I don't remember a recording or a live experience because I just always wanted to play the drums. I don't. My mom says that she says that was one of the first words out of my mouth was drum. And I don't think the age of 2 or something that I'd be influenced by a certain recording. But I mean, maybe. I would say I do remember which album turned me on to jazz, and that album was Miles Davis. That was definitely the record that made me want to, do this, do this for a living, and do this for the rest of my life. It's not that I hadn't heard other records before that. Someone had given me a Buddy Rich record when I was about probably 10 or 11, and I liked it, but I wasn't super drawn to it. And then it basically was, it wasn't really until I heard the way that, you know, Tony and Ron and Wayne and Herbie and Miles were interacting on that Miles Smiles record that I wanted to do it. You know, like, finally I heard that and I was like, ooh, I don't know what they're doing, but they're communicating on a level that I want to do and understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So growing up in the DC area, were you, and I'm guessing we're about the same age. I'm 47. I'm guessing mm-hmm. we're more or less the same age. So were
yeah,
you,
I'm 44.
So were you listening to Go-Go at all, or were you more of like a pop and indie rock person as a teenager? Because in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of that in DC, obviously.
Yeah.
So.
No, I was total Go-Go. in fact, I've been talking about Go-Go a lot lately because I've been running into some of my old homies from D.C. I just spent a week with a great alto player, Bruce Williams, and we were talking about Go-Go a bunch, and we actually played some Go-Go for the students we were working with at this NJPAC all-female jazz residency that we were working for. I'm a total D.C. Go-Go teenager. And I think it was really because I was a teenager in the late 80s, so I think it was a really special moment for Go-Go, and I'm heavily influenced by that. I'm also really influenced by the pop of that era, the 80s pop, you know, like especially more of the R&B pop. I'm a super big Prince fan, and you know, anything having to do with Prince. So, like, I was really into The Time, which was another band.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really into Earth, Wind, and Fire back in the day. So, yeah, I was into all those bands, but Go-Go definitely had a huge influence on me. And I also worked in a record store back then when I was a teenager. And, you know, pretty much on a weekly basis, we would get DC Go-Go cassettes in, you know, delivered to the store for sale. And, you know, they were all cassettes back then, and they were all just basically live board mixes, kind of, you know, they were like the early day bootleg.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's pretty much what Go-Go still is. You know, there's still a store that I like to go to in D.C. when I'm down there, and in the front of the store is like a telecom store where they sell cell phones and things. But then they also in the back have a bunch of Go-Go bootlegs that are just basically board mixes from shows. Yeah. I'm glad you asked that question. In fact, one of my first tunes on my first record is called Big and Lovely. It's a song that I wrote for Toshi Regan, who's also from D.C. And that tune totally has a Go-Go swing, Go-Go beat.
Nice. Yeah. You have kind of a rock sound to my ear, like not just the way you hit the snare and stuff, but like the way your drums are mixed a lot on your records. Do you think that's because you kind of travel back and forth between folk and rock and jazz and other stuff, or is it just what you've always wanted to sound like?
I mean, I think we're all influenced, of course, by, you know, where life takes us and our careers, and I'm definitely a person that has moved through genres, and you know, I'm considered a versatile player. I would say, you know, for the sound, I try to go for, you know, especially in the studio when I, you know, and especially when I'm making my own record, so I have a little bit more say in the, that's the sound of a record, or, you know, I can kind of go along for the whole ride through mixing process and mastering. You know, first and foremost, I'm going for clarity. I really like a clear sound, and I'm going for a warm sound that highlights the qualities of each drum on the drum kit, you know, and sometimes, and also that highlights the type of music I'm writing. So, you know, I think, especially on my latest record, Boom Tick Boom record called Glitter Wolf, the drums definitely have a more rock sound. And I think, you know, part of that is because of the producer and the engineer. and the kind of discussions we had about the sound that we wanted to achieve before we made the record, and what would serve the music that I wrote for this record the best. And part of that was a kind of a decision to make the, we wanted the drums to be kind of more up, a little more upfront and beefier than my previous records, and kind of bring in more of that rock element that I also have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you listen to my last two Boom Tick Boom records, the preceding one, which is called Otis Was a Polar Bear, the drums are smaller, and they're definitely mixed and tuned more higher and more like a jazz kit. We might have put, you know, they were recorded in a really big room, so they have that kind of, you know, rockish ambience. But they're definitely a higher pitch, smaller drum. And then on this newer record, I tuned the drums lower and kind of went for a beefier sound. And, you know, I actually, it's funny, I don't always think of my sound as being that. I really just go for what is appropriate for the music, you know, because it depends on what I'm doing. You know, if I'm playing in this other band that I'm in called Artemis, we're playing straight ahead music, and I definitely don't tune my drums super low. I tune them a little higher. Not as high as the Bebop Cats do, but I definitely tune them a little higher because I feel like that's what's appropriate for the music. And the one thing that actually usually never changes is my snare sound. And you know, so when I'm thinking about tuning, I pretty much am talking about the bass drum and my floor tom and my rack tom. And I almost never change the size of my kit. It's almost always the same sizes and almost always the same amount of drums.
So yeah. You don't have, like, you know, a little three-piece kit for some gigs and then, like, the giant Billy Cobham kit for other stuff or anything like that?
Maybe just in my drum studio by myself. No, I do sometimes add I sometimes like to add a 16-inch floor tom, so I have two floor toms. I sometimes like to do that, but it just depends on the setting.
Mm-hmm. And when you're recording, I mean, because you said, you know some about this because your dad was an engineer, and I studied engineering at the New School as well, so I'm kind of interested in this stuff as well. So do you put a million mics on the kit, or is it just like a couple of overheads and a couple other things? Like, you know, for the mm-hmm. Glitter Wolf record, how much, you know, how much of that did you have going on?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been working with the same engineer for the last four Boom Tick Boom albums. So he knows what I like, and after we had that discussion, we had this discussion about making them beefier and, you know, pumping it up a little bit, and he got real excited. And I think he's really, actually really proud of this drum sound on this new record. So, you know, I just trust him because we have about a 10-year working relationship, and he likes to use ribbon mics, and he definitely mics each drum. He uses an old ribbon mic as an overhead, which sounds really great. And then he uses, I'm trying to remember what exactly he did on that record. He has a couple room mics, but, you know, I also set up in the same room with the pianist, so with Myra. So we don't, you know, I'm not really, you know, when you're an engineer, so you studied engineering, so when you're in the same room with the person, with especially piano, there's that latency that happens, and I'm really picky about that. I don't like it. I can hear it easily in recordings, and so I really don't play, I try not to play too loud when I have that situation, and that doesn't mean I'm playing with any less energy. I just try to keep it a little bit, you know, sonically contained, so it doesn't, so there's not too much latency into the piano mics. But he did have, I think he had at least one or two room mics. I'm a fan of a lot of mics. I like that. You know, like, I remember in the mixing process, we were mixing one of the tunes on the record, or I wasn't there, but he was mixing, and I sent him notes. By the way, his name is Adam Munoz. I don't know if I said that, but he's a great engineer, and but he lives in San Francisco, so I would send him notes, and one of the my notes was like, oh, you know, there's this one section during Ben Goldberg's contra alto solo, it's the drums almost sound too modern to me. Is there any way we can make it sound almost like a soul record from the 50s, you know? Mm-hmm. And he basically, I think, switched over to this mic, this Royer mic that he had as a room mic, and that completely made it sound like a 50s soul record. And it was just subtle. It wasn't like we completely changed the sound of the drums for his solo. We just brought in that mic, which gave it this kind of lo-fi compressed sound to the higher end of the kit. And I really love having that option, you know. And if you don't have enough mics, then you don't have that option. And also, if you're recording in a studio that is high level, top notch studio, you know, then you have access to all these incredible mics and all this incredible outboard gear. So, you know, might as well take advantage of it.
Yeah. Because as you say, you can always rough things up after the fact, but if you get a rough recording to start with, you can't do much to clean it up.
Exactly. And you know, I also don't like super clean records.
When I started listening to jazz, like in the 90s and the 2000s, I would occasionally buy stuff on Telarc, and it was always these super clean, super digital sounding, just incredibly precise records, and I would go listen to them. I was like, why do I hate this and love, you know, like old Blue Note albums, you know? And I didn't know anything about sound at that point. I just knew that this shit all sounded like super chromed and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, part of me thinks that's what's wrong with a lot of jazz records today. It's like, it's too clean. Everything is too clean, and the music is too perfect, and you know, there's something about, and also most people are listening to things on super low quality digitally, you know, and so it kind of sucks all the raw life energy out of a recording, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Summer is like jazz camp central for me. I do a lot of camps, and I was just teaching at this camp, and I had this great conversation with the other faculty members about this, and how, you know, we were listening actually to a lot of music on CD. We were playing CD examples for the students, and even CD sounds way better than listening on Spotify or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's just such a difference in the sound, and we were trying to explain to the students the difference, and they were nodding their heads like they got it, but I'm not sure they did, you know, because they're so used to streaming everything.
Yeah. I've actually been thinking about this and talking to other musicians, you know, and just hoping that maybe somebody will try it. Somebody that has a budget for a record will try it. But I feel like if people are going to listen on their phones, maybe you should mix records in mono again. You know, it'll really, it might have that punch that like old 50s singles used to have, you know?
You know, that's a good idea.
I feel like if you're going to put your record up on Bandcamp, maybe you offer the mono mix, you know?
Right. That's a good idea, actually.
So,
you know, my first record that I made years ago, I don't even want to think about how long it was, but I was just thinking about it last night, because I went to see Billy Childs, his Laura Nero project at the Jazz Standard, and it was really, honestly, one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. It was incredible, and I ran into Steve Wilson was playing with Billy, and I hadn't seen Steve in a while, maybe in two or three years, and he's on my first record, so we were kind of talking about that record and, you know, kind of having a laugh in general about how, you know, touring that record and kind of jumping in like an old school Continental and driving around the East Coast, and but it made me start thinking about that record, and, you know, Lenny White produced that record for me, and he and I really went for it. Like when we recorded it, you know, we wanted it to sound like an old Blue Note record, so we mixed the drums completely. I think it was like, I haven't listened to that album in a long time, but I think the drums were completely mixed on the right. Like the whole kit was on the right side, and just the reverb of the kit was on the left side. And like those old Blue Note records, and it sounds so cool. I'm like, man, I should do another record like that.
Yeah. I heard a record a couple years ago by this band called Disfear from Sweden. They're like a punk metal band, and the drums were mixed in mono. Everything else was in stereo, but the drums were in mono, and they were just sitting right in the middle of the mix. And they were so loud and aggressive. It was just, you know, it was like the whole record was emanating from the kit. You know, it was crazy.
Wow.
Let me ask you about that album, because I was going to ask you about it anyway, but you know, since you brought it up, you made that record with a bunch of like sort of veteran players like Bruce Barth, Ray Drummond, and Virginia Mayhew, who I know sort of gave you a break early on. And like, you know, these are all people with like a million credits and a million projects behind them. And I've noticed that people do that a lot on their first album. Either they surround themselves with this kind of security blanket of super experienced, super pro musicians, or they make an album with their friends, you know, people their own age who are just coming out of the gate themselves. So why did you choose the path that you did?
Yeah, well, you know, I made that record when I was 28, and I was really still heavily in a period of being mentored by older musicians. You know, I really value and honor that quality of this life we call jazz. And you know, it's really important to mentor with older players. And I was in the middle of that then. So a lot of the people that were hiring me and a lot of the people that I was, you know, honored to share musical experiences with were older musicians and seasoned musicians. And, you know, I felt really lucky to, you know, first of all, have Lenny White offer. You know, he was giving me lessons at the time, kind of lessons slash hangs. And, you know, to have him offer to just produce it for me as a friend and as a mentor, that was huge. And then to have, you know, to have the courage to ask the great Ray Drummond to play bass, you know, on my record and have him say yes. I mean, it was really an honor. And they, you know, I think when you're making your first record as a leader, it can be a really scary process and frightening, and, you know, you're investing money. And you know, I was pretty frightened, and I wanted to feel like I had musicians join me who had my back and who also were just so much better than I was, so that so I could rise up a little bit closer to their position. You know, like that's a whole thing. You know, you play with people that are better than you, so you become better. And you know, they have, you know, all of those musicians have, you know, years and years and years of experience playing in the studio. And I had a good amount for my age at that point, playing on as a side musician. But you know, I really needed to feel comfortable with people and feel kind of guided by them. And they were so supportive. I mean, you know, Steve and I were laughing about this last night, because he was saying, "Oh yeah, remember when we did that tour?" And you know, the funny thing is that we made that record, and you know, I did it because I just somehow, for some reason, just wrote a bunch of music. You know, and I wasn't planning on becoming a band leader. I just, at that time, I was going through some stuff in my personal life, and so I just, you know, couldn't help but write music about it. And then afterwards, I thought, well, I guess I should record it, you know. And you know, I think Lenny also encouraged me to ask really who I wanted to play on it, you know. And so that gave me the courage to ask Bruce and Virginia and Steve and Ray. And then after we made it, I said, okay, well, I guess I should try to book some gigs. You know, it was kind of like my entry into band leading, you know. And I booked, I'd say, 4 or 5 gigs on the East Coast, and I borrowed my first teacher's old Continental. And we got in this Continental, me and Bruce and Steve, Ray decided to drive himself. So we were like a caravan of musicians driving around the East Coast and doing these shows. And I still can't believe that they did that with me. You know, I mean, here, you know, I'm like 28, and they're used to just traveling the world on a high level and getting paid a ton of money, and they decided to join me in and drive around in an old beat up Continental and do these gigs. I mean, it was really quite a honor to have them agree to that.
So I want to ask you about some of your non-jazz stuff. Because, you know, you've done a bunch of that. How did you played on a Natalie Merchant album, The House Carpenter's Daughter. How did that come about, and what was the experience like?
Yeah, well, you know, I've actually had a really long musical relationship with Natalie. I still work with her, and it wasn't until, you know, she doesn't work very often, but the very last tour she did, which was two summers ago, I did not do because my son was just born, so I needed to stay home. Mm-hmm. But I've worked for her for a long time, and I've, you know, made, actually, House Carpenter's Daughter was the first album I did with her, but since then, I've done two or three other records as well. So, you know, Natalie, the way that the Natalie thing came about was, you know, interesting. I think it was like 1999, possibly. I'm remembering this because I was living in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, and I remember getting a call from her, and she left a message on my voice machine. This was like before we were all using cell phones, and I didn't believe it was her. You know, I was like, who is prank calling me and saying they're Natalie Merchant, you know? And then I was also like, but this person does a really good impersonation of Natalie Merchant. So I actually kind of let it go for a day or so. And then I realized, I actually think that was her, you know? And I called her back, and she said she'd gotten my name from Jesse Murphy, who's a great bass player. And he and I were doing a bunch of restaurant gigs at the time. And it turns out she was looking for a drummer that, in her words, was a little more jazzy, you know. She wanted someone who could play brushes and kind of approach the music in a more like an organic kind of jazz. I think in her mind, she thinks of jazz as sensitive, more sensitive. So I think she was looking for someone who would be more of a dynamic player and be more sensitive. So Jesse had recommended me, and so she called me, and I went up and did. I wasn't the only person she called. She called a bunch of drummers, and then I went up to her house at the time she was living in Rhinebeck, went up there and did the audition and got the gig on the spot. And it was really exciting for me because, you know, I was a real big 10,000 Maniacs fan when I was a kid. And I also was a fan of her first solo record, Tiger Lily.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know, to get the opportunity to work with her and play those old tunes was really special for me. And I think that was also kind of a big shift in my career. Well, definitely a huge shift in my career, because before then I was only playing jazz and I was playing pretty straight ahead jazz. And I think working with her kind of opened my mind up to different styles of music, and what's playing different styles of music and actually pursuing them as a career. And I, you know, I mean that with like singer-songwriter music, pop music, even within jazz, because at that time I really wasn't listening to avant-garde jazz or crossover jazz or modern jazz. I was really listening to the classics and playing that music as well. So I think working with Natalie really opened me up to just kind of realizing that good music is good music, and that I was interested in not just playing one genre, but I was interested in playing all types of genres.
Yeah.
And she also, you know, she also really taught me how to play behind a singer. I think when I went in with her, I was really young, and, you know, I was chopping out all the time, and I think I had that young under 25 ego, and that I just thought I was, hot shit, thinking I could do anything on the drums. And quickly she schooled me and made me realize that, it's not about what you can do on the drums, it's about when you choose to do it and making sure you don't get in the way of the lyric, which was huge for me because I never thought about that stuff before her,
Mm-hmm.
It was great. I really, I value my relationship with her. She's been a wonderful mentor as well in my life.
Yeah, yeah. You were also with Annie DeFranco's band for a couple of years. What did you learn from that experience? Like, not just as a player, but in the sense of, what she offers in terms of how to be an independent musician and make it financially viable and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say this. I love Annie DeFranco. I love everything she stands for. I love her artistry. I love her intention on stage. Like, we toured all the time. I toured all the time with her for about 3 years, and never once did she exude a feeling of not being 110% committed to every lyric she sang. I mean, it was incredible. I learned how to perform with her. She means everything she does. I'll always just look up to her. I think she, I learned that you can do it independently, because I have done, most of my career, and my career as a band leader has been independent. Just in the last couple of years, I've had more help, but most of it was all my own work. I learned from her, one thing she's great at is selling merch. She funded all of her tours just by selling merchandise, and she would have a plethora of products to choose from. So she'd have t-shirts, every CD. She did bootleg CDs. She had keychains, underwear, you name it, she sold it. She had a real product. She was great. Her people and Annie were just great at marketing her career, with Righteous Babe Records. So I do that too. Like, when I'm on the road, even, with Boom Tick Boom or Parlor Game, we always sell t-shirts, we sell vinyl, and we sell CDs. And it really does help fund the tours, for sure. I learned that from her. I learned also that you just have to work a lot, and work really hard. And I learned that the skill of really being in the moment, because with Ani, there was nothing was ever the same, performance wise. So like, mm-hmm. one night she might sing a song, let's say Napoleon, which is one of her classics. So let's say she sings Napoleon one night, and she might on the fly decide she wants to sing the chorus really quietly. So I would always have to be completely tuned into her, and watching her body language, watching the way she moved her guitar, and also the way that she moved her mouth. Like, I could read her direction, or her intention, by the way she would move her mouth, the way she was singing. And she might sing them, she might just start, all of a sudden she's singing really quietly, and I would have to follow that and not overpower her lyric. And then the next night she might sing the chorus super loud and want me to really hit hard. So it was never the same, and it was always a surprise. And I thank her for that, because I really developed that skill to be able to tune in to the artist and really be on the fly and be in the moment.
Mm-hmm. That actually leads me to another question, because I noticed that you were also with Brandi Carlile for a couple of years, who is, I don't know how big she is, but pretty big, I would imagine. And so when you're playing big theaters or arenas or whatever, and the set list stays more or less the same from night to night, do you start to think of it as one big piece of music, or do you always still have to think about the individual song and the individual moments within that song? Because, you know, big, like a big metal concert, for example, is basically a traveling musical. You know, the lights are going to hit and everything's going to happen more or less at the same time within a few seconds of each other from night to night. So was that the case with that, or was it less structured than I'm imagining?
It was pretty structured, you know, near the kind of, I'd say the second half of my time with Brandy, she started getting they started getting into opening the show with a drum solo, which was really fun for me because there was no, definitely no rhyme or reason to that as far as my the structure of my solo. You know, I definitely played in a rock and roll style the drum solo, but I always switched it up, so that gave me kind of this feeling of being in the moment and improvising, which felt good. But yeah, no, you know, Brandy definitely is more of the vein of like coming up with the grit, the, you know, the set list that always works and pretty much sticking to that set list for a whole tour. And Natalie and Ani are not the type of musicians that do that. Natalie maybe a little more, but definitely not Ani. So yeah, for me that was a challenge. You know, I had to really dig deep to keep it fresh and pull from the elements of each song that kept me kind of excited about the music. And I say that not because I don't like Brandy's music at all. I think she's an incredible artist. I say that because I'm a jazz musician first. So, you know, there always needs to be some kind of element of improvisation for me to kind of keep my attention, you know? And I think it was just a little more micro with Brandy. Like I would, instead of, with Ani, I could improvise a lot. Like she, the more I improvised, the more happy she was, you know? With Natalie, there was a lot of room within each groove to improvise. And with Brandy, there wasn't as much room to improvise, but where I could find my moments within each song where I could very subtly switch it up each night. And it might not be something that would even be heard. It's more felt, you know, like I would, I'm trying to think of a good example. I would shift my fills up a little bit, you know, I would shift up the way that I would play ghost notes on the snare drum, which are basically all the little notes inside of each groove that you can't always hear, but they make the groove feel really good. Like, you know, all my favorite drummers have those amazing ghost notes, like Pretty Purdy and Steve Gadd and Matt Chamberlain, all my favorite pocket drummers. So I might shift that a little. It was always a real challenge to make sure the music stayed steady, because none of these artists that I've worked with ever use click track on stage, you know, and a lot of pop artists use click track on stage these days, but none of those artists ever did. So that was always a real kind of wanted challenge. I love the challenge of making sure the band doesn't rush or slow down. And I was kind of the hired gun in that band, so I was, that was always a real focus for me when I would get up there. I'd be like, okay, my intention and my job up here is to make sure that the music stays steady and has a flow and sounds fresh and sounds like the first time we're doing it. And it's challenging, but I feel like I was able to rise to the occasion and I enjoyed it a lot. And Brandy's a real powerhouse singer. She doesn't care. She hardly even needs a sound check. I mean, she can just, she's very comfortable just jumping on stage and singing. She never uses in-ear monitors, and she's, most artists these days use in-ears. She just uses monitors. She doesn't care how loud I would play. It doesn't, nothing phases her. She can just belt anything. It's pretty incredible.
Was it in Ani's band where you first met Todd and Jenny and Todd Sicafoos and Jenny Scheinman?
You know
And
what, actually,
did you know right away that you wanted to do something of your own with them?
you know, it wasn't right away. It wasn't with Ani. I actually met Ani through Todd. Yeah, I met Ani. Ani knew of me, and of course I knew of Ani, but Ani knew of me because of an artist that I used to play with named Aaron McKeown. And She knew of that, who was also signed to Righteous Babe Records. So she knew of me through that band. But then she also heard me play at the 55 Bar back in the day with Todd Sickafoose's band, Tiny Resistors. And I think that show was, I remember it being really fun, but I think the band was me and Todd, Jenny, Andrew Bird was sitting in with us, and Shane Ensley from Kneebody, and Adam Levy on guitar, somebody, there were a lot of people on that stage that night, but Ani was there, and that's where she heard me. And then maybe shortly after, she called me and asked if I wanted to come down to New Orleans to kind of spend a week and hang and play. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. I actually met Todd through Jessica Lurie, who's a great alto player. And I met Jenny even before then. I met Jenny through at the Knitting Factory back when it was on off of Church Ave in Tribeca, and or in Soho. And I think she was playing with Adam Levy or playing with her own band. In fact, I think she and I even played there together. This is a long time ago. And I always knew that I was going to do, whenever I did have a band that kind of stuck, I was going to have Todd on bass. But Jenny, I didn't exactly hear violin in my band at first, but, I have Jenny in my band because of her, because the way she plays music. It's not particularly for her instrument, but it's just her musicality is so deep to me, and I love what she brings to the band. And she and I are also really good friends, so that kind of helped the way of our musical companionship.
So when you first put Boom Tick Boom together, there were no horns. It was the four. It was you, Jenny, Todd, and Myra Melford. And mm-hmm. Myra, to me, is better known as a leader. Like, she doesn't do a lot of work in other people's bands. So how did you convince her that this was a project that she wanted to be part of?
I begged. I begged over and over. I still beg. I still, every time we have a show, I go, okay, Myra, I know you're busy. I know you're overwhelmed, but... And I, of course, understand if you can't do it, but you're my number one. You know, like, I'm like, I respect Myra. You know, I'm kind of old school in that way, that I really, I like to show a lot of respect to my, kind of my idols and my mentors, you know, and I consider Myra to be one of those. And so I have some serious high respect for her. But, you know, I first played with Myra at the Jazz Standard with Marty Ehrlich a long time ago. And that moment, that from just that single night, I knew I wanted to try to have a band that she was in. And so it started because I wrote a bunch of music, and I was able to get this gig at the jazz school out in Berkeley, California, and she was available. And it was like a summer show in August. And I did it as trio, and she had a really good time, and we had a board mix of that recording, and it really sounded good. And so from that moment on, I basically asked her, would you record this music with me? And that was the beginning of that. And it was just trio. It was almost the entire first record is just trio, and then I have Jenny on one or two songs. And, you know, she isn't really a side musician, but I think there's a quality in my music that brings out this Chicago blues side of her that I think that she really enjoys. And I've always really made a point to, you know, show a lot of respect to her and work around her schedule. And she, you know, I think she and I, we've become really good friends, and I think she respects me and I respect her. And I think she likes my work ethic, and I, of course, like hers. You know, like, we're kind of simpatico in that way. And so I think she's kind of hung on, you know? Like, she's kind of hung on to Boom Tick Boom all these years, even though she really doesn't do a lot of, like, any side musician work at this point, you know?
Yeah.
So You know, I mean, I don't always have her. I've accepted that. I will always make my Boom Tick Boom records with her. But I, at this point, I have like two or three great subs for her in Boom Tick Boom that just kill it every time. One being Carmen Staff, you know. But I think she and I respect each other, and we, I don't even know. I can't even explain it, but she hasn't left me yet. So I'm just going to keep praying that continues, you know. In fact, she's going to play a New York show with Boom Tick Boom coming up in September, and I convinced her to fly in for it. So, you know, I feel honored and excited. She, you know, for me, I mean, Myra's she's all fire. Like I just think she's the bee's knees. She's a master.
Yeah. So you compose on piano, I guess. So do you just write melodies and let the other people in the band kind of make their own contributions to the arrangements, or do you present like fully formed pieces and say, here's how this goes, you know, how does it work?
Yeah, well, usually, I mean, the band has gotten larger over the years, and I will say that's solely because my writing has shifted, and I'm hearing more voices. So I hope I stop now, because I can't, afford like an octet or anything. Although, you know, it's so funny because I'm working on a commission right now. I'm writing a new piece of music, and I'm really having to like stop myself from adding more instruments, because if I have to, I will, but I'm trying to keep it as a sextet. But yeah, so I mean, I write on the piano, I also write on the bass, and I also write on vibraphone. And I think it's mostly, you know, I start with like usually a little nugget, a little thematic, melodic piece of material, and then it builds from there. And sometimes that piece of that theme will become a bass line, ostinato, in one of my songs. And sometimes it becomes the melody, or it becomes a counterpart. But I do arrange all the music as well. I mean, it's kind of integral to my composing process. They're almost one and the same at this point. So as I'm coming up with material, I'm imagining how I would break it up or how the musicians will play it. And it often really informs my composing first and foremost. So, and that's actually, I really have a passion for arranging and orchestration. And I'm actually, that's kind of what I'm studying a lot right now and I'm really into. And that's one of the reasons I have Boom Tick Boom, and I love the challenge, because I love the challenge of arranging for violin, clarinet, cornet, bass drums, piano, you know. And I like those sounds. I really like clarinet and cornet together. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of all in the same. Now, once we're in the rehearsal process, which we actually only really ever rehearse before we make a record, we never rehearse other than that, but before we make a record, I bring all the music in. It's usually overwhelming. Like I write 15 or 16 new songs, and usually there are mistakes because I'm a drummer and I make like harmonic mistakes, or you know, like sometimes you know, the people will be like, oh, I think it's easier to read if you have it as a flat, not a sharp, you know, things like that. And then we get into it, you know, and the arrangements are there, but somebody, you know, I really encourage my bandmates to express their thoughts, and if someone might say, hey, might be cool if we brought that section back, you know, or maybe we should cut off two bars of the changes here because it seems to move more naturally without those two bars of chords, you know. Mm-hmm. So everybody's really, it's like once we're in the room together, it becomes a real collaborative process, and I really encourage that. I mean, I don't think I would have a band of band leaders if I didn't encourage that. You know, everybody is a band leader. So, and everybody composes in this band, and I admire everybody's skills as a composer. You know, I mean, Todd is one of my favorite composers, and as well as Myra, she's one of my favorites. So, and Ben, I mean, and they're all great. So I encourage it, and we kind of come up with the final arrangements together. But you know, the initial arrangement is there. It's just it might shift a little bit. And you know who's kind of the renegade in the band? I don't know if you could guess who that would be. Can you guess?
I don't know. I'm gonna
Jenny's the renegade.
Is
so
she?
Like,
okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm the first to admit that I don't really know how to write for violin. You know, I try, you know, but it wasn't until like this last record that I actually called her and said, "Hey, can you tell me like the best keys to write for violin?" She's like, "Thank God you're asking me that after four records." You know, she's like she's like, "Not the keys that you wrote the last three records in." So, you know, like, but Jenny, you know, I don't know all the techniques of the violin, you know, I mean, I read about them and I study it, but that's different than really knowing it, you know. So for this last record, you know, like, she comes up with little parts she likes and she'll just start doing them. And if I don't like it, I'll ask her not to do it. But I mean, 9 times out of 10, I love it. And then I just say, "Hey, can you write that down somewhere and do that?" It's awesome, you know. So she's kind of the one that really kind of immediately brings her own spirit to her part.
Would there ever be a time where you would be open to just full-on outside compositions? Or are you still, you know, are you still going to want to write the, you know, the bulk of the music yourself? Like, would
you
let Kirk
bring in
a tune, you know, or something like that?
Well, that's a good question. On my last, I'm trying to think, I guess 2 records ago, there's a record called No Morphine, No Lilies that we did, and that has one of Myra's tunes on it called The Kitchen,
mm-hmm.
which is a great tune. And we always play that tune live when Myra's on the gig. And then the record before that also has 2 of Myra's compositions. So, but my last 2 are all my originals. And I think I'm totally open to that. You know, for some reason I haven't done it the last 2 records because I've written too much material for the records. Like, you know, three of the songs we recorded didn't make this latest record, you know. So mm-hmm.
Also,
but,
the
yeah,
last
I hope...
2 records are the first ones to have the same lineup from album to album.
Yeah, you're right. Wow, you're teaching me things about myself. Yeah, you're totally right. Totally. Yeah, I think that's the band right there, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
for better or for worse, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
we're like a family, you know, mostly functional, a little dysfunctional.
I think what's really interesting to me about Boom Tick Boom's music is the kind of party music feeling that it has. Like, you're playing almost parade beats a lot of the time, and then there are pieces where, you know, Jenny will pluck the violin like a ukulele, and like the horns get very jumpy at times. It's like very loose, vibrant kind of music. So I mean, how did you arrive at that as the band's voice?
Yeah, well, especially this last record, I really wanted this to be a celebratory record, and I wanted it to kind of like continue this journey of really keeping melody and groove in the forefront. You know, I wanted strong melodies. I wanted it to have a party groove vibe. Not like a we don't take ourselves seriously vibe, you know, but I wanted us to have a good time. You know, it's like our 10-year anniversary, you know, and I wanted to celebrate that. I think also our energy on those days of recording was real party-like. Like, we were really into it, you know? So I think you could hear that on the record. And that was really important for me, was groove. You know, the last few years I've been working with a few choreographers, and it's been really, mind-blowing to me, because I've kind of reconnected drums and dance and the importance of that, and kind of, you know, having that be a priority. As much as I love to play free avant-garde out-of-time music, and I'm that has just as much validity as pocket drumming, you know. I really have kind of honed in on wanting to make people want to bop, you know, move and dance when I play. So that was really important for me, this record. And I had this kind of like, I did a self-imposed test on myself for this record, where if a song didn't give me shivers at any point, then it wasn't going to make the record. And it doesn't mean that it's going to give shivers to other people, you know, but it was kind of my own self-imposed test. And if the melody didn't move me in that kind of way, then I decided it wasn't going to make the record. So that's really kind of where I went with this album.
You mentioned Carmen Staff earlier, and last year you made the album Science Fair with her. And that's a very different kind of a record from the Boom Tick Boom stuff. So what were you going for with that one?
Yeah, well, we wanted it, the sound is really different as well. Like, we wanted it to be more of a, I guess in some ways, more mainstream in the jazz world. And I think also the personnel that we chose is more mainstream. I hate to say mainstream. I guess just more more specifically in the jazz world. You know, having Matt Penman on bass, and I mean, Dana Stevens is one of my favorite musicians on the planet. He can play anything, and I love his sound. And then, of course, Ambrose, I think, is just one of the most masterful musicians of our era, of my era, definitely. You know, I think he is, whether he's Ambrose or not, you know what I mean? Like, he is just an incredible musician. So, and you know what I mean when I say Ambrose or not, you know, like hype or not, he's an incredible musician. So
yeah, and he stretches too. He does some really interesting things on his own records, like with strings and poets and, you know.
His last record, Origami Harvest, is gorgeous. I love that record. And I admire his ability to write for string quartet. I mean, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to write for string quartet, and he's doing it. It's beautiful. Substantive and also very meaningful on a deeper political social level, you know. But I, you know, we wanted this instrumentation. We all kind of, except for Matt, we all kind of collaborated one summer at Stanford Jazz Workshop, because all of us teach out there, and we had a couple musical moments that were really poignant. One for me being Ambrose and I taught him like an all camp masterclass together, kind of on the fly, and so we played duo. We played for about, I'd say, 20 to 30 minutes straight playing duo, and it was a really incredible musical experience. It was like one of those musical experiences that I will have in my pocket when I'm on my like last breath, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a really special moment, and that's when I realized how much of an incredible musician he is, and how deep he listens. So after that experience, he and I both really connected over that, and I said, man, we gotta do something, you know. And he was like, yeah, I'm totally in. So that's how that came together. And then, you know, that record was a real collaboration between me and Carmen. You know, we each brought in four tunes, and we workshopped them as a duo for, a good 3 or 4 months before we made that record. And we kind of, you know, each tune is definitely written by the person that wrote it. You know what I mean? Like, we have our styles are very different as far as composing. Mm-hmm. But both of us were really open to the other person kind of giving suggestions or, you know, arrangement ideas. And I think in doing so, that made our compositions flow really well together. And that's part of why it's called Science Fair, is because it felt like we were getting together and having science lab every week, and like, you know, playing around with the songs and arrangements. And in that process, we actually developed a really deep connection musically. And she and I have we've made a duo album that we're going to be putting out next year. She's also in Parlor Game. So, you know,
if you have time for just one more question, I do want to make sure to ask you about Parlor Game. because it's Jenny and Carmen and then Tony Scher on bass. And I feel like the interplay between the violin and the drums gives it a kind of folk feel that comes through a lot of the music that we've talked about today, you know?
Yeah.
And so does jazz need to think of itself as a folk music more often in your mind?
You know, it's funny. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, I think it does, you know? I think it needs to remind itself that jazz is, that it is the great American art form. You know, it is one of the great American musical forms, and it comes from a place that doesn't start in a classroom. It comes from a place that starts with the people, for the people, and is directly, should be directly connected to what's happening politically and socially during that time that a song is written or people are playing it. And I think that sometimes these days is getting lost. You know, a lot of players are moving to New York and Chicago and LA and San Francisco, and they're great players, you know, but the bulk of their experience is from playing in school, and they're learning how to play in a classroom. And I think that lends itself to music that lacks soul and that lacks this kind of human rawness that we need, that's directly connected with life. So in that sense, yeah, I think it does need to remind itself that it's folk, that it needs to be connected with the good folk of mm-hmm. folk music.
Yeah.
And folk in general, you know. I do. I mean, I straight up feel that way. I am all for pushing boundaries and everything, but when you lose the soul and the intention of the music, then what, why are we doing it, you know? I was recently involved talking about music with one of my heroes, William Parker, the great William Parker, and he said I want to hear music that makes me want to get up in the morning and get on with my day, you know, like
mm-hmm.
I need to be moved. I want to hear music that makes me want to get out of bed and celebrate life, you know. And that's so true, you know, like we need to hear music that uplifts us and makes us want to continue doing what we're doing.
Okay, that was my conversation with Allison Miller, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the content on the website and the show, and maybe even start creating some exclusive content just for subscribers. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.